Now, there you go.
There's Tim Trout, right?
So, no.
Refurbishing old equipment with Al Davis.
Yeah. This is valid. You got something that's totally messed up. Go ahead and take the hose to it. And this is something. And you know, actually, another thing that I've done for cleaning faders is take it out and put it under the faucet.
I guess as long as it's really dry when you put it back in.
Well, it actually, ideally, yeah, but actually water is not a good conductor of electricity, so you don't really have to be that fussy about getting it really dry.
Well, the water I grew up with was about 26 kiloohms for about a few
years. Yeah, well, there's some, but anyway, I've done that, where take the faders out, just run the water through, and then let it dry, and then... spray a lubricant, the old, like the old tuner cleaner or mineral oil.
Right.
And actually try that. If you got some faders that are starting to feel bad or starting to get scratchy, and you might
probably what? Not going to make them worse.
You're not going to make them worse, and you might make them just like new. You might even make them better than new. Because depending on what you got, let's use this to lead in. Because a lot of times you might have an offer of an old mixing board from. It's actually pretty common that one of the NPR stations in the area, there's a new LPFM coming along, and they've put in all digital stuff, and they have some analog boards laying around, and they say, here, you can have them.
Mm-hmm.
And so. So you take a look. So you look in there, and of course it's tempting to say, "Yeah, sure, we'll take it." The first thing is you look and see what kind of condition it's in, and take the hose.
Is this the FCC thing?
No, the FCC is out there.
On the other side, yeah.
Okay.
And so you hose it out. You get it clean, and because that's the first thing is get it clean and you check out the wiring. But the main All right, but there's a couple things to look for there. One would be the faders. And, looking at the faders, all right, deciding whether it's worth fixing or not. Look at the brand on the faders. You got Penny and Giles faders? Some of these old boards have Penny and Giles faders. That's a gold mine.
Even if the rest of it doesn't work, just keep the faders.
Even if the rest of it doesn't work, just keep the faders.
Mm, how do you know if a fader is in condition of being refurbished?
You have to try it.
What
I was saying is you clean if sometimes they're okay the way they are, but if not, you clean it out. You can run it under the faucet. Some of them actually come apart for cleaning.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway.
So you hook up the board and you listen while you...
Well, you could do that, or actually, if you got a board that's filled with mouse droppings or something, you might want to clean it out
first.
I just see it like tuning a guitar almost, you know? Like, you have a reference of how it's supposed to actually sound. Like, how do you know... Yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah, anyway... a little hidden trick, though, when you're looking at the faders, is to in terms of refurbishing the board, if you're not gonna gut it and rebuild, because actually I remember in college at the AM radio station, the guy there decided to just gut and rebuild, but keep the faders, keep the enclosure, and put new electronics in it. And I remember doing that at the FM station also, as we replaced the germanium transistor-based electronics with op amps.
Anyway, so.
But anyway. Okay.
The trick for faders.
The trick for faders. Well, first of all, if you have. Let me look at this. Depending on what kind of faders you have, if you have the thin kind, like these.
Thin vertically?
No, they're just like this. these are the cheaper ones.
They don't go far below the
They don't go far below, and they don't really have a very fancy mechanism. It's just basically a sheet metal and a like.
You're saying not very thick. You mean that they're deeper or they're wider?
Look, this is actually on standoff because the shaft is too long. But you see, they're really very. They don't take up a lot of space.
Oh, and that's the cheaper one.
These are the cheap faders, and.
Can we pass that around?
Yeah, you can pass it around.
What's up with this one? That one's nice and huge.
That one's nice and huge. Actually, this is a little
startling. Is there a reason there's a difference between this
really well, huge that, one? Well, that's a better quality fader.
Okay, so when you say thicker, it's a lot thicker.
Well, so when you look at the faders, this is one of the things to look at in a used board. You look at the faders, and if you have that the thin type there, the thinner ones, they don't cost very much money, but on the other hand, if you have the other type that's enclosed, which has rails inside, those are easier to deal with. The thing about the bigger one there is that if you look at the what you notice that the one has a better feel than the others.
Yeah, it's like smoother and everything.
Yeah.
You have to. I bet like I don't know. I mean, sound concept that would be like just. Happening it and it would make a difference, I feel.
Well, yeah, but anyway, that's one thing to look for. And if you have a situation where the faders don't feel good, a lot of times cleaning and lubricating will fix it. I can clean and lubricate those the cheaper ones, and for a week or two they'll feel just as good as the expensive ones.
Lubricating with like. WD-40 or
they make you used to be able to get it at Radio Shack with a spray can and
it's called a tuner cleaner.
And I haven't been able to find a can of that in a long time.
But anyway, but as far as lubricating, you could use mineral oil or. But
where do you get spray mineral oil?
I just use a dropper and drop it in.
Oh, so you don't literally spray it?
No. Okay.
Syringes work well.
But okay. But anyway, one of the things.
Yeah, you can get film needles.
So in terms of the faders, there's generally three. They generally fall into three categories in terms of quality. There's the flat ones there, and then there's the. Let's say the mass-produced ones with the rails, which is the bigger one there. And then there's Penny and Giles. Penny and Giles is a particular brand. And if you have a used mixing board with Penny and Giles faders, that's like gold.
You can probably take them out and sell them on eBay to buy yourself a new board.
You might be able to do that. And actually... I make these, my boards, you can use any of the three, depending on what your budget is. But
great.
But anyway, the Penny and Giles faders cost about $100 a piece.
Okay.
And so...
All right. It might be good to go through the FCC check list. The FCC check list, it might be good to do that one.
Yeah.
Wasn't Rivendell?
No.
Rivendell is not for another hour.
Oh. Okay. What did you say?
Hi. Rivendell will be here, but it's not for another hour.
Yeah.
Anyway. So evaluating, you got the three different grades of faders, where the the typical cost of a fader. The little thin ones are maybe $4, $5 a piece to in a not huge manufacturing quantity, but in a quantity that you might be able to buy from DigiKey or something. $4 to $5 a piece in the quantity that I might buy them at, maybe up to 10 if you're buying one. These here might be like, I think I pay about $8 for these. But they had a minimum order of a few hundred of them.
Oh.
If you get these in a quantity of one, you'll probably pay about $15. But the penny and Giles faders, you'll probably pay in a quantity of one, maybe 150 or something. And in the quantity I might buy, maybe $75-$100 a piece. And so you can see why they use the cheaper faders.
Yeah.
Because of you got a 12 fader board, $100 a piece for the faders, there's an extra $1,200 in parts cost.
Yeah.
And but then if they're selling this this board for $15,000, at that price you expect the premium parts. That's what you're paying for. But another thing to watch for on the faders is do they use VCAs, voltage controlled amplifiers? That's a foreign term. Okay. One way of using a fader is they take the audio signal, they put it on one end of the fader, and they take the audio out of the fader. The fader is, and just as a rotary pot, the fader is a big resistor with a little wiper arm on it. And you feed the signal across it, and the wiper arm slides up and down, and you slide it up to the top, and it gets the full signal. You slide it down, it gets less and less, and that kind of fades. And so you decide how much of the signal you have by at what point this wiper arm picks it up. And the traditional circuitry would have two of these elements inside of here, and one for left and one for right, and it just feeds audio in and you get audio out. There's another way of doing this, and that is with what they call VCA, voltage controlled amplifier. So the voltage controlled amplifier means that the fader itself doesn't have audio on it, but rather it has a control voltage.
So how would I figure this out if it had the VCA?
You could look at the schematic to see. What?
I mean, isn't it visible, like, when you open it, don't you see, like, two sides to it?
No, not necessarily, because a lot of times they make them with two sides to them anyway.
Okay.
Because a lot of people want them that way, and it's a little printed circuit board type of assembly, and it's just cheaper to make them all the same.
Okay.
And so a lot of the ones that are sold as single element really have two elements in there. They just only put the terminals on one.
Okay.
But so you may not be able to tell based on that. But what you can, one difference this is refurbishing equipment.
I stopped everything.
Yes. Come on, have a seat.
No, I gotta do a thing. No, I never refurbish old equipment. Okay. I have all the money in the world.
Okay.
But anyway.
But everybody else. Right?
And anyway, one of the reasons you have to know this, I mean, actually, that gets into another thing about if you're going to refurbish equipment, is to understand something about the circuitry that's in it. But the VCA, there are some people that think the VCA is absolutely the way to go, and then there are some other people that think it isn't. And basically, voltage-controlled amplifier is an amplifier that you control the gain by feeding a voltage into it. You feed a different, higher voltage for higher gain. Well, actually the traditional design would feed 0 volts in for unity gain and up to 5 volts for 100 dB of loss. So the early DBX design, let's say the Dave Blackmer design, the design that you find in all of the DBX stuff, and the what you find in some of the older API consoles, for instance, that might use VCAs. Anyway, the DBX stuff, you know what DBX is. It's one of those companies that makes equipment. They make compressors and stuff like that. Anyway, the way they do their automatic gain control is there's a VCA in there, voltage controlled amplifier, and the typical DBX design, since they were first invented in the 60s, you put 0 volts on the terminal and you get unity gain, and 5 volts is 100 dB of loss, and it's actually linear in dB. So 1 volt gives it 20 dB of loss, 2 volts gives it 40 dB of loss, and And it's actually very nice in that regard. You put minus one volt in and you get 20 dB gain. Minus two volts, you get 40 dB gain.
It turns into an input.
Minus six volts, you get 60 dB gain, and the thing goes unstable at that point and starts oscillating. But anyway, in terms of the fader, so they need a different design for the fader to do that. And the reason is the taper, because if you have a if you're just putting audio in on the on your fader, you want what they call an audio taper. The audio taper means that, roughly speaking, it's a logarithmic curve, so that you get something that's relatively useful. If you use a linear taper for audio, you find that the control would seem to be all scrunched up at one end, and it would be very difficult to use. And so the VCA, if you have a fader designed for a VCA, it would use a different taper so that the output would be the appropriate DC voltage to make the VCA act appropriately. And so if you're refurbishing and you have a board that has, it has Penny and Giles faders in it, and then you look and see it has VCAs. So you just have to be aware of that fader with the VCAs is going to have the wrong taper if you try to use it for audio.
And how would I know if it has VCAs?
One way of doing it is if you take a voltmeter and you or a scope and you look at the fader, put some signal on it, and if you see audio on there, it's audio. If you see DC voltages, you could just take one of those voltmeter,
right,
and measure the DC voltage. And if there's a DC voltage there, it's VCAs. Now, which actually gets to another point, getting away from the faders. I can be on the faders enough?
You tell us.
Okay.
You're the guru.
All right, getting away from the faders is to look at the circuitry. If you're trying to determine whether something is worth, first of all, you're probably not going to run into too much stuff that's so old as to not use op-amps. Because if you do, it's classic and you should restart.
I will call you.
But anyway, most of the time you're not going to run into stuff that's so old as to not use op-amps. There's a short period of time when they tend to make everything discrete, solid state, and before that everything had tubes.
If you get
something in that vintage, anything that's pre-op-amps is classic, and you should restore it as a valued antique. But as far as op-amps go,
when you say op-amps, you mean like LM741, like a...
Yeah, an op-amp. Everybody know what an op-amp is? No. Okay. An op-amp is an amplifier on a chip, and it's a particular kind of amplifier on a chip.
Can you point at one in your sample there?
They're hiding under here. But anyway, the circuits on here are dual op-amps. But of course, you look at a chip, all chips look the same.
Yeah.
Which is one thing that if you look at one of these any integrated circuits, you're just simply looking at it, it'll give you no clue of what the
battery
does. You have to find the number and look it up. But anyway, an op-amp, short for operational amplifier, is an amplifier that has, all right, typically extremely high gain. So high, I'm going to say it has infinite gain. Let's just make believe it has infinite gain. It's so high. And usually, you'll see on a schematic with this symbol here, it looks like a triangle, and it'll have two inputs and one output. And the two inputs when you look at the schematic and see this, you'll see that one input has a plus sign on it and the other has a sign on it. And inside here is an amplifier with very high gain. And there are a bunch of these to choose from that have different characteristics. They're only a little different characteristics. Like, for instance, there are some that are optimized for very low noise. There are some that have higher output capability. There are some that work well with a high impedance circuit. They're designs for different applications, but they all basically work the same. And they're all kind of sort of interchangeable. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by kind of sort of interchangeable is that a lot of times in a pinch you can just plug in a different kind. In my boards, I use three different kinds of op amps. Three different kinds, and all three kinds are dual op amps. That means there's two of these in a package. And they're all the same on the outside. They all have eight pins. You got one, two, three pins here, and a dual op amp would have another six. One of these for three more pins, so you're up to six. And now you got two more pins for the power supply, and there's your eight pins. And so most equipment that you will see uses these dual op amps.
Is that something I'd need to replace?
Sometimes you need to replace these and sometimes you don't. And when you look at these dual op amps, who said 741? Well, a 741 is a single op amp, which means it only has one of these in the package. And it was, and it came out about 1960, and it was considered to be obsolete about 1965, so you don't really find too many of those in use.
It was in all my do-it-yourself circuit guides.
Well, that's because they were written when the concept of an op amp first came out.
Yep.
And they haven't been updated since then. But a 741 is a rather old op amp. But anyway, I use three different kinds of op amps in my boards. And they all have the same pinout. They're all kind of, sort of, interchangeable. Now, what I mean by kind of, sort of, interchangeable is that, and this is something you need to think about, look at when you're refurbishing, is that I use, let's see, 45, 62, 55, 32, and an LF353, the three kinds of op amps that I use. And you'll find... And if you look at anybody's equipment, you might find a combination of those. These 5532s are super common. You open up a lot of boards and you might find it has 1,000 of these 5532 chips in it.
Wow.
1,000?
You know.
A large amount.
A large amount. And so I use the LF353 for most stuff in the middle. I use the 5532s for output and the 4562 for the first stage of a mic preamp. And one of the reasons for the choice is, for me, these are about 25 cents a piece, these are about 50 cents a piece, and these are about $2 a piece. And so if I use these everywhere, it'd be a really nice board. but at $2 a piece, that drives the price up a bit. And so I try to minimize the number of these that I use. They have different characteristics. So what happens if I swap them? What happens if I have a spot where I'm supposed to use the 4562 and I stick an LF353 in the socket? What's going to happen? It'll work fine, except it's a little noisy. And that's really all that it'll be. It really will work fine. It'll just be a little noisy. You just turn the fader up. So that means that in a pinch, if you got one of these that's blown out and you only have one of these in your box, go ahead, plug it in, and it'll work. But also that gives you an idea of ways to upgrade. If I have older equipment, and let's say I have older equipment that has 741s in it. One thing that you can do to it to improve its performance is one thing you can do if you have an older board with 741s in it to improve its performance is to replace it with newer, higher performance op amps.
And then I'm almost guaranteed at the same pinouts, or do they always have the same pinouts?
Well, there are standard pinouts, and actually they of course you have to look, you have to check.
Right.
But these three that I've mentioned here are all dual op amps. That is, there's two op amps in a package, and they have the same pinout. If you look at the single op amps, if it's an 8-pin single op amp, chances are it'll have the correct pinout. And I said LF353. There is also an LF351. A 351 is the same as a 353, except that it's only one of them. So if you have a 741, which is a single op amp, you can replace it with an LF351 and get improved performance.
Hmm. And which one makes the big hiss?
Well, the
cheaper ones.
Well, the cheaper ones. Actually, the 741 is, well, it was a very early design. And of these three, the LF353 is really designed for high impedance circuits. It's good for in the middle, low gain, like the mix bus and middle gain stuff. It's a little noisy. The 5532 is pretty quiet. It's pretty decent. It's a good all-around op amp. And this is why I believe Arrakis uses only 5532s. And they have a completely different chip for the mic preamp that is not a standard op amp. The 4562, like I said, they're $2 a piece in quantity.
Right.
And so, I mean, I have to pay $2 a piece for these. You might have to pay $4 or $5. And so something like this is used only where you're willing to pay that kind of price. And so I use these as mic preamps because it's very low noise. It's lower noise than any of these others. And so it also has a good hefty output. But anyway, so there's some guidelines, some hints on refurbishing is to look at the op amp, look and see what's in there, and chances are most of the stuff you'll run into will have the 5532s, or there's another one. I'll put it on the same line here, TLO72. I put it on the same line as an LF353 because I think of them as being equivalent. But anyway, if you look at a lot of boards, you'll find a combination of these in there. And now the 4562 is a fairly new chip. The 5532 came out about 1975, and the LF353 also came out about 1975. So we have a situation here of, let's call it, mature technology, where these products have been available for a long time, and they're going to continue to be available for a long time.
Means that you scarf them out of other boxes.
Yeah. Right. All right, getting back to the op amp, what this thing does, like I said, it's an amplifier. The amplifier is, you put a little signal in here, it comes out big. And it has lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of gain. Way too much. Way too much. And so what they do is they put they use concept of negative feedback to control the gain. And so if I put a resistor, if I have my input signal here and I put a resistor here to the inverting input, and I take another resistor from the output back to the inverting input. All right? I'm going to take the non-inverting input and ground it. So I'm just not going to put any signal in there. I have to connect it to something, so I'm just going to ground it. I take these two resistors, and remember, this has lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of gain. I can completely control the characteristics of this thing by those two resistors. And in particular, if I make these two resistors equal, let's make them both the same. Let's make them both, 10K. 10,000 ohms. You just kind of pick that number arbitrarily. But I'm making them both the same. If I make these both the same, this has a gain of 1. That means, actually, minus 1, because it inverts the signal. So it has a gain of minus 1. So I put a signal here, I get negative of that signal out here. At the same level. It doesn't make it bigger or smaller. And it acts like a buffer. Let's say I make this 100K. Who can tell me what the gain is now?
10.
That's
100 divided by 10. Negative. Is this resistor divided by that resistor? Negative, because it hurts the phase. Negative 10. So I have a situation here where it's making the signal bigger. What happens when I flip this around? Let's put 10K here. Let's make this 100K. Now what's it do?
Nothing.
No, not nothing.
Plus 10.
No, it's not plus. This resistor divided by that resistor, 0.1.
So it's just 1?
No, 10K divided by 100K, 0.1, 1/10, it's making the signal smaller.
Yeah.
Why would I want to do this?
Because that's your fader.
Well, actually, you can use this technique for your fader. But one of the reasons I might want to do this is I have a very big signal coming in, and I need a smaller signal. I could make it, and I need it buffered.
What's the value of buffering in this case?
Buffering maybe isolation so that you don't load it down.
Oh, load the output of the other.
Driving it down.
Okay.
There's a number of reasons why you might want to do things.
And but, for refurbishing, we might not care why.
Well, that's true. Actually, if all you want to do is reduce the level of the signal, you probably could do this with just a pair of resistors. But one advantage of doing it this way is that you have a good solid source here, where just a pair of resistors, it's high impedance and
subject. I'm thinking one refurbishing reason for a buffer would be, in my case, I was hoping to get a stereo mix board this weekend, and I'm not. So that means I'm going to take all my stereo outputs and turn them into mono, because all I have right now to put a station on the air next week is a studio mono mix board.
Okay. Now, if you have... Here's another point about if you have a stereo input and you want to turn it to mono, what do you do?
I'm going to join them together, but with something to keep not short them together.
Okay, right. You want to join them together, but with something to not short them together. You know, one thing I could do...
Which means I'm... Yeah, I need a buffer of some kind.
Let's put this back to 10K unity gain. Well, if I have two of these and I just short them together, it's not going to like it. It's not good to just short.
When one's high and one's low, they're going to work against each other.
They're going to work against each other. If you have two batteries, let's say a 9-volt battery and a 1.5-volt battery, and you put the two in parallel, you short them together, you're going to get some pretty big sparks, right? It's not a good idea. And so what you can do to short them together is connect them together with resistors.
Then I lose signal, so...
You lose signal. Now, here's looking at this buffer circuit. If I have another signal here, resistor, and let's make this 10K, I have one channel, the other channel, resistor 10K here, 10K here, and 10K feedback resistor. If I just look at this, remember the gain is minus 1. It's this one divided by that one. Well, if I just look at this one, it's minus 1. It's this one divided by that one. Right?
No, because they're joined together.
Well, wait a minute. Let's say I forget about this one. These are all 10K.
Okay.
There's a B in here.
What?
There's a B in here.
Yes.
But they're, these are both 10K. They're both the same. The gain is minus this one divided by that one. Right?
I'm sorry, I'm a little distracted by the whole B thing.
Oh.
All right.
It won't bother you if you don't bother it.
All right.
Yeah. So the gain is minus this one divided by that one.
Okay, so if they're both 10K, it's 0.
Now let's forget we have this one. Just look at that one.
Okay, and that's 10K?
Yeah, this one divided by that one.
It's 0. No, it's one.
Well, it doesn't really matter that this other one exists. If I put a signal here and a signal here.
Right. Well, what I'm worried about is buffering those two outputs against each other.
Well, that's what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
Is that here's an output, here's an output. I have a resistor here.
Yeah.
I put these resistors here. That isolates those two outputs.
Yes.
So that means these two things sum going into here.
Yes.
Because each one, you make believe that the other one doesn't exist.
Okay.
So these things sum nicely in the sense that I can feed this on one and this on another, and it makes the sum of the two. This is a common circuit. They do this all the time. Every mix board has essentially this circuit in it.
What is the minimum resistor that would isolate the two stereo outputs of typical hardware?
Well, it depends, but if you're using this circuit, if you're using this circuit, something around 10K is a good value with the 10K feedback resistor. That's actually another difference between these op-amps, is how much of a load they can drive. The LF-353 is not particularly good at driving much of a load, so you have to keep the load resistance fairly high. And the general guideline on a 353 is you want at least 2K, 2,000 ohms for the load. Or we have 10K here, so if I have the input is 10,000 ohms here, and I'm feeding it with a 353, that means that one 353 can drive five of these. Or something like that. Anyway, the 353 likes them fairly high. The 5532 can drive around 500 ohms, so it can put out more current, and that's one of the reasons to use it. But in terms of if you're hooking things together for mono, I would go with about 10K for that.
All right.
But anyway, so all right, I've talked about the different op-amps. A little bit on op-amp theory here, just to give you an idea of how they work. And this bit about assuming that the gain is super, super high and doing everything with the feedback is a common circuit design technique that is used all the time. And it's a way of setting the gain to whatever you want to set it to. And if I put in instead of putting a resistor here, I can put in a network of resistors and capacitors here. I can get it to do equalization. I can get it to have. I can do a lot of stuff with it. And so just about all audio circuits are based around this. Where I just put different networks in here to do different things. And I put a resistor capacitor network here to do equalization. And there's equalization from equalizers, tone controls. There's also equalization in things like phono preamps, like hooking up a turntable. Because the output of a turntable, you don't want a uniform response in the preamp. You want a response that is going down as you go up in frequency. You want the gain to be tilted so that I get the most gain at very low frequencies and I get much, much, much less gain at the higher audio frequencies. It's tilted all the way through the audio range.
Because
that's how the records are recorded. It's tilted a precise amount that there is a spec that says exactly how much you're supposed to tilt it. And they do that with a network of resistors and capacitors in the feedback here. And so you can make any kind of response you want by doing that.
So it sounds like when I look inside one of these, I'm going to see op-amps with resistors and capacitors.
You're going to see op-amps with resistors and capacitors in there, yeah. So in terms of refurbishing, see what kind of op-amps are there. Are they in sockets? That's good if they are.
Easier to replace.
And actually, there's one thing to look at, and is that a lot of equipment, older equipment, mostly you will find the op-amps are in sockets. and the resistors and stuff are all wired so that you can work on it. But a lot of the new stuff has some surface mount components where they're all made by machine. And the and even these op-amps are surface mount. They're soldered on. And
they're hard to work on.
They're very hard to work on. And so if you get one of those, it just might not be worth bothering to fix.
Right.
So, let's see. Oh, another thing I want to talk about here. If you're looking at old equipment and thinking about what goes wrong with it with age, of course there is the mouse droppings problem. but if you get something that's been well maintained, let's say I get some classic equipment that's 20 years old or something. Let's even take something really optimistic. Suppose somebody donates an API console to your station. You know, API is a real high-end brand of audio consoles that's used in big recording studios. And somebody donates this thing, and it was made in 1975. And what are you going to do with it? And you get something that's of that age. The main thing that you're going to have to look at, because, all right, let's look at the reliability of different kinds of components. Resistors are, let's say, perfectly reliable. Resistors never fail on their own. You might blow one out, but they never fail on their own, practically. These op-amps, the semiconductor devices, once in a while. But when you get old stuff, the main failure mode, the main thing that's going to make it not sound good or whatever, is capacitors. Inductors, coils, it's coil wire. Those things are reliable. But the main thing that's going to make it not sound good is capacitors. And when capacitors go bad, it's the kind of thing that you're listening to it and you know it just doesn't sound right. It just somehow, I don't know, right? I mean, this is the kind of thing that if the capacitors are going bad, this is what you'll find.
And you get a lot of the chassis shocks here.
The chassis shocks.
Yeah.
Well, that could be, but in turn that's you're getting old into the tube.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But
I have an old Helicraft if you have to worry about it.
Oh, okay. Well, capacitors, but anyway. There are different kinds of capacitors. There's ceramic capacitors, there's film capacitors, there's, ready for this, electrolytic capacitors. The ceramic capacitors are pretty reliable. They're almost as good as resistors. The film capacitors are reliable and they sound good. The ones you got to watch for are the electrolytic capacitors. Now, if you want to see electrolytic capacitors, you see these little black things there? They look like little cans. And those are electrolytic capacitors. And they're usually marked with a polarity.
Plus and a minus.
Plus and a minus. Now, a capacitor, everybody knows what a capacitor is.
It's sort of a little battery. Sort of.
It
holds a charge.
A capacitor is two parallel plates. You can think of it as parallel plates that holds a charge. And they're marked with a number known as a capacitance, which is basically the equivalent size of the plates, how much charge it holds. And the circuits are generally designed to have a particular amount of capacitance, so it holds a particular amount of charge. They use them in equalization circuits here, so that I put a capacitor across the feedback resistor, that's going to make the high frequency response drop off. And I picked the right value of capacitor to get the designed amount of drop-off. Now, electrolytic, the other place that capacitors are used is as coupling capacitors. I'll put a capacitor here and then go on to the next stage. Now, what the coupling capacitor does is it blocks direct current from going through. Capacitor lets high frequencies go through. It blocks low frequencies. And in particular, what the coupling capacitor does, the important feature of it is that it blocks DC. Because coming out of this amplifier, I might have a little bit of DC offset, and I don't want that to get through, because if the DC gets to a switch it'll go pop, pop, pop every time I flip the switch. If the DC gets to a pot, I'm going to go every time I adjust the pot. And so they put capacitors into block DC. These are fairly large capacitors. These are very often electrolytic capacitors. The other thing the other application of electrolytic capacitors is in power supplies. They're used for filters. They're used to clean up the power to these op amps so that noise from the line doesn't get into these op amps, into your circuits. All electronic equipment has filtering on the power supply, despite what some of the power supply filter what some of these AC line cleanup filter companies will make the claim of. Everything has filtering on the power supply built in. And so that's a place where they use these electrolytic capacitors. Problem is the electrolyte is something that's kind of like a liquid that's inside there, and they tend to dry out with age. They tend to go bad. And so that's something that you run into in refurbishing is the need to replace how many of them are in here? Of the capacitors. And you might find that...
How many years do you think would be a suspicion?
How many years do I think would be a suspicion? Well, 10.
10?
Now, but that's...
I know.
All right, in terms of that, there's a few things to think about. We have the coupling capacitors, we have power supply capacitors, and the power supply capacitors, you may not have too many of them, so they might be easy to replace. The ones that are, if the power supply capacitors are going bad, there's two ways capacitors can go bad. Short and open. Mm-hmm. Actually, there's more than that, but for concept right now, let's think of two ways. Short and open. Now, if I have a power supply capacitor that goes bad short, you're not going to get any power out of it at all. You might get some smoke out of it.
And if you had a fuse in there, you probably don't anymore.
Yeah. Now, on the other hand, the other way a capacitor can go bad is open. All right. Open means, well, you might as well take it out and have nothing there. Now, if your power supply capacitor goes bad in the direction of open, it might not work. You might hear hum as an
like a lot of hum.
A lot of hum. But now, when it comes to these, the audio capacitors, the coupling capacitors, and these are the ones that they get go nuts over in terms of recapping. There's another way that capacitors go bad, and it's kind of sort of in the middle. A variant on the kind of sort of in the middle regarding short is leaky, as in you get a little bit of DC leaking through, and the kind of sort of that they go bad, that's kind of sort of like, let's see, they get leaky, and kind of sort of towards open means that they get like a high series resistance. They get lossy. And this is the situation where in the audio, in these coupling capacitors, it just doesn't sound right. because you need enough, it needs to be fairly big to pass the low frequencies. So if they go bad, they get less capacitance and it starts to lose bass.
Uh-huh.
And this is in the category of kind of sort of doesn't sound right. It's losing bass. Sometimes they
start to sound tinnier.
Yeah. Yes. Or if they start to get a high resistance, the high series resistance, you start to lose all of it. Maybe the level drops, and this doesn't sound right. And this is when you go replace them. Now, I've also seen this in speaker crossovers. One thing about electrolytic capacitors is that 5 minutes? Okay, 5 minutes. Electrolytic capacitors are polarized, which means you have to put a DC voltage across them to make them work. Hey, that's great for power supply. But here, as a coupling capacitor, they tend not to be properly polarized. So if you have a capacitor that's properly polarized, you might, let's call it 20 years. But in this situation here with the coupling capacitors, a lot of times what they do is they use a polar capacitor because, you know, it doesn't really hurt if it's reversed a little bit.
Right.
So they think. And so a lot of these boards have polar capacitors as coupling capacitors. And they go bad. So this is the case where they say, oh, I have to recap the mixer. All 600 capacitors.
Oh, my God.
And because these are polar capacitors. Mm. And that's a lot of work. So this is the kind of thing that you look at it and you say, do I really want to do this?
Yeah, I'm thinking about redoing the electrolytics in my car computer because it's 25 years old.
Oh. Car computer, yeah. But anyway, this is probably the most common refurbishing issue that you'll run into. You look at the thing and you got to replace all the capacitors. Like if somebody donates to you a used API mixing board, in this case it will be worth replacing all the capacitors. But that's what you're going to run into. And that's a case where you look and see, is it through hole? Are they through hole or are they service mount? If they're service mount, you're supposed to cover them.
what about other things like that stations would be looking for, like CD players and tape decks and speakers?
Tape decks, pretty much this applies. CD players,
I find the mechanism's always dead. It's not the electronics.
But tape decks, all of this still applies. Now, with the tape decks, now you get into the mechanical side.
That's right.
Where
is it worth? Nobody uses tape.
Oh, yeah. With tape decks, you clean and lubricate all the joints.
Oh, right.
Actually, tape decks, it's fairly... A way of deciding whether a tape deck is worth refurbishing is look to see how many motors are there. If it has one motor in it, probably not. If it has three motors, most of them have one or three. Three motor tape deck, they're worth fixing.
And CD players, if I get some that seems like the better quality ones have replaceable mechanisms?
Some of them, well, actually, depending on what you want to do, they all might if you can get the mechanism.
So yeah, we can't just use the CD drives and get out of computers and attach it to that control pad. Because they're so cheap, right? So it's a control pad.
Yeah, but they may not be very good.
They're
different.
Because it seemed like maybe I had a Denon once or something better than that. And you might even been able to just pull the whole unit.
I don't think you can just pull, but they do come as units.
So if I found one that had easily available replaceable units, maybe I'd want that.
Yeah, but actually, if you have an old CD player, you might not. I mean, that's one thing about deciding whether it's worth it, because CD players are not expensive.
Right.
And so the question is it worth the work?
Right. Especially for the potential unreliability.
Right. And so it's really the what's worth the work is generally
mixing console.
Mixing consoles, traditional, let's say legacy style audio equipment.
Could you spend two minutes or so on, I'm in the field and I'm going to test this electrolytic capacitor, and I know open's going to be obvious, and I should get a sweep on my meter as it charges, right?
Right.
So
right.
How do I test that in-between state? Like, what's a quickie test to figure out, is this thing leaky?
So that's hard.
Oh, okay. This is going to have to be your last question.
Yeah.
And I just need to make a quick announcement. Any of you guys are parked out on the street, even though it's a holiday, the parking regulations are being enforced. The two-hour parking is being enforced. If you park where the meters are free. But we're really recommending that you just go down a block and a half and park in the free state parking over there. So we're going to allow everybody a little bit of time to go and move their cars and come back in.
Okay.
Thank you all for researching that.
Last question.
Okay. And by the way, that's where your car is parked. Where they're telling you to park. But anyway, testing a capacitor. Testing electrolytic capacitors. You use your own meter to charge it up, and you'll see it.
initially will start conducting, and it'll conduct less until it isn't conducting anymore.
So it'll start at infinite resistance, and then it'll say, oh, whatever,
well,
20,000, 10,000.
It'll start almost like a short.
Yeah,
and the resistance will go up.
Okay.
And then
right, you put it in ohmmeter mode. Right.
You put it in ohmmeter mode. And now after you've done that, now you put it in voltmeter mode.
Ah.
And you measure the voltage across the capacitor. And you wait a little bit. And you measure the voltage across the capacitor again. And if it pretty much holds its voltage, it's okay.
Okay.
But,
I didn't think of that second step. I just kind of
Now, another thing about this is that, I looking at these capacitors, is there are polar capacitors and there are nonpolar capacitors. One way that if you have equipment that has polar capacitors here, which is almost all of it, you can upgrade it significantly by replacing these with nonpolar capacitors. And they do make nonpolar electrolytics. And the new nonpolar electrolytics will probably fit where the old polar one was. And this is a way of making a significant upgrade in the equipment. But and actually, you also find sometimes the nonpolar electrolytics used in speaker crossover networks. Because the nonpolar ones dry out just like the polar ones. But they don't get toasted by spikes like the polar ones. You'll find these nonpolar electrolytics in speaker crossovers. And if you have some old speakers, sometimes you just go and replace the capacitors in the crossover network. You can make it sound a lot better. And I guess I have to leave.
So when you say nonpolar, you mean nonpolarized. They don't have a plus and minus.
They don't have a plus and minus.
So they're non-polarized electrolytes.
Right.
And you want the non-polarized electrolytes.
For this application,
right.
Yes, you
for
do.
That. That's right.
For this application, yes, you do.
Thanks, Al.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, this is the Geek Squad.
What?
The Geek Squad.
Of course. It's refurbishing old equipment.
If you come across anybody that's looking for a cabinet, an old Gates studio turntable, I've got one.
Okay.
Just...
I know a guy with some telescopes.
I guess
hybrids.
That's one of the reasons why I don't have to hurry too much, because you're going to come and throw me out.
Yeah, I'm looking for the projector that I heard was in here.
I think it went out there.
Oh, yes, I think you're right. I will go get mine.
Yeah.
Oops, pardon me. I sneaked by here. Oh.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.